This is the Furled Sails Sailing Podcast. This is show 144, Marvin Creamer, part 2. Today is the 15th of October, 2008.
Hi, this is Christy.
And this is Noel.
Welcome to Furled Sails, the world's first sailing podcast. Our show notes are located at www.furledsails.com. Well, this week we have part 2 of Marvin Creamer's wonderful interview where he tells us how he navigated all those ports with no instrumentation.
So which is amazing.
Yes, it is. So here's the interview. We hope you enjoy it.
Okay, so I think I've got a pretty good idea of how you cross the oceans. But I'm having this failure of imagination on how you actually made port. I guess there's some ports where there's some pretty good landmarks, right?
Yeah.
So as you come up to the shore, you can see that there's a mountain here and a bay here.
I think I'm pretty clear on most of them. The first landfall was in South Africa. Now, we were told that there's such a parade of oil tankers coming around the southern tip of Africa that we would know we were approaching Africa without even using watercolor or any other detection device. No, there weren't any tankers.
You went on the one day. There was no tankers.
I don't know if you understand. Cape of Good Hope is about 100 miles northwest of the southern tip of Africa. The southern tip of Africa is Cape Agulhas.
Okay.
And after about 98 days out of Cape May, we saw this blinking light and identified it from our light list as that of Cape Agulhas. We had gone from Cape May to the southern tip of Africa without sighting any land at all. Although in the vicinity of the Cape Verdes, our sails got muddy when dust off the Sahara condensed in the dew on the sails, and they actually ran red mud streaks. That gave us a hint that we were near the Cape Verdes and it was time to turn south instead of proceeding southeast. Okay, well, we got to Cape Agulhas in about, I guess, about 2 o'clock in the morning, waited till daylight to make absolutely certain that we weren't wrong, and then we cruised up to Cape Town. Well, we got into Cape Town by just following the coast, and we did have charts, so that we were able to identify all the lights and landmarks along the way. So that was Cape Town. Now, then for the landfall in Australia, we had gone north to the western edge of the Great Australian Bight. Now, we did that because the prions and the appearance of prions, the warming of the atmosphere, the changing of clouds from squalls to nice billowing cumulus clouds told us that we might possibly have passed Australia and were looking at the conditions in the East Australian Current.
Okay.
If that were true, then we were facing a lee shore of New Zealand, which would be not acceptable. So in order to determine exactly where we were, we turned directly north, sailed north, hit the southern coast of Australia, identified our position on the western side of the bight, and that was our longitude now, meridian, and then we crossed that with a line from a star in Scorpio. I think it was Theta, if I remember right. By the way, that was a pretty nasty piece of water in southern Australia because there's the Recherche Archipelago, and Australia is drifting north and leaving rocks behind, not only standing up out of the water, but snags below the water, which will create bomboras, almost like the geysers coming up when the southwesterly swell hits those underwater obstructions. Well, anyway, we identified that south coast of Australia, as I say, with a meridian from the western coast of the Bight and a star in Scorpio, and then we're able to figure out a heading for the southwestern tip of Tasmania. Now, approaching Tasmania, we had to use a bit of caution because that coast is unlighted. It's 180 miles long. There are only two lights on that whole coast, navigation lights, and there are only 10-mile visibility. The coast itself is rocky. The charts tell you you have to have local knowledge. There's no settlement, no towns with any lights along that coast. So we were sailing in very stormy weather and heavy swells coming up in the southwest toward a very forbidding coast. Rather than heave to at night, we decided we would parallel the coast. Well, the coast runs northwest, southeast. So we sailed southeast parallel at night and then turned northeast to close as rapidly as possible in the daytime, and did that for several nights when we thought that we were approaching. The water shoaled, and we got knocked down in that shoal water, so that we knew that Tasmania was coming up. Well, by doing the zigzag northeast and southeast, we were able to accomplish, according to the rule of cosines and sines, 7/10 of a day's run. Whereas if we have heaved two during the night, we would have heaved two for 14 hours out of the 24. So we were able to advance at a time when the swells were getting more intense, storms were getting more frequent and stronger. So there was a strong urge to get in out of that weather. So after paralleling the coast for a few nights, there came a morning when I turned, and I always took the dark to daylight watch, turned the boat off to the northeast, and within an hour had the very tall peaks of some mountains in southern Tasmania in view. Looked like little sawteeth sticking up on the horizon, but quite recognizable. So we just sailed toward those sawteeth, and they turned out to be mountains in southern Tasmania. Then we followed the coast along the, paralleled the coast till we got to the Derwent River, identified the landmarks by charts that we had on board. Okay, that was that landfall. Then the next landfall was East Australia. Well, we went out into the Tasman Sea, got into 90-mile-an-hour winds, and I told you about being the mast being turned down 50 degrees below the water, and the shards of glass cemented the ceiling. Well, we turned toward the east coast of Australia, identified the southeast corner, which, by the way, is where Francis Chichester's boat Gypsy Moth 5 came to grief. The heirs, Chichester's heirs had loaned it to a round-the-world racer, and he smashed it up. I think it was Gabo Island. I'm not sure of that. But we sailed past there and just followed the coast up. Got into an interesting situation 50 miles south of Sydney. The sky clouded over. The wind quit. And we depended on wind for our direction at night. The rules of the international navigation regulations say that a sailboat to be avoided, in other words, to take its rights, must maintain course and speed. Well, without wind, you can't maintain course. You don't know where you're going under a cloudy sky. So we could have motored, but we had no sky to steer with. So we elected to go into a little port called Kiama, followed a fishing boat in, little tiny harbor, and got gigged by the port authorities because that was not a port of entry. Well, we got that straightened out. We told them we were dropping a sick man off, Jesse Edwards, who was the one who elected to fly home. So that worked out okay. Then the next day, we just followed the coast up to Sydney. Okay. That was all coast-wise piloting.
Okay.
The New Zealand landfall was made at night, and we aim. We used the Chichester method of aiming off. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but he developed that for flying planes. Instead of flying directly toward a target, he deliberately aimed either right or left of the target, and then used a log for distance and turned left or right to home in on the target when he had traveled that distance. Well, we did the same thing in our approach to New Zealand. Instead of aiming for the northern tip, which we wanted to sail around, we aimed below the southern tip and came in on Taroa Point Light, again, about 2 o'clock in the morning. Within just a few miles, in spite of the fact that we'd had two heavy storms going across the Tasman. Okay, that we sighted, and I would say that was about 40 miles south of the southern tip. We just worked our way around in thunder showers around the northern tip of New Zealand and into a little harbor called Whangaroa, spelled Whangaroa, Whangaroa, but pronounced by the locals Whangaroa. Okay, we went in there. When we then our next landfall after that was Cape Horn. We actually never saw the horn. We saw the island 60 miles west, but got into a heavy blow and either had to take a tack away from the horn or one that would have turned us into the rocks of South America. We elected to veer off. So we actually passed the horn, according to the tracker, maybe 8 or 10 miles south of the horn. Okay, now probably the toughest landfall was the Falklands. We got into a heavy blow after we passed the horn, 3 days of it, and no thinking about a landfall then, because just turning 15 degrees to port or starboard would produce a sound that sounded like we were getting hit by a Mack truck. A real solid bam sound. Well, it eased up after 3 days, and I said to my crew, "How would you guys like to spend the Christmas holidays in the Falklands?" Oh boy, we'd love that. So then we had the problem of finding them again in complete overcast. Well, we sailed a direction that we thought was toward them, from what little information we had. We were buzzed by an RAF plane. They took our pictures, by the way, which we were able to retrieve when we got into the Falkland. Then we floundered around in motoring with weak wind and were really striking out. But then we saw the petrels. That gave us some hope. And shortly after we saw the diving petrels moving from starboard to port, we got a heavy wind cold front out of Antarctica. It wasn't enough to produce any visible clouds at our location, but 3 hours after blowing over top of us, we saw clouds, big, heavy cumulus clouds, rise into the sky. Well, the old geographer knew immediately what that was all about. That cold air had hit mountains high enough to cause condensation in clouds, and there the Falklands would be underneath. So after 3 hours of sailing, we were able to find the West Falkland Island and didn't get to the break between the two sets of islands, West and East Falklands, until after dark. Well, we exercise prudence now. Just in case of a heavy blow on shore, we ran well offshore to give us sea room during the dark hours, then came back and found the East Falklands, the other side of the channel between the two. And then it was just a matter of coastal piloting to get into Stanley.
Now, was that the top secret British military base?
Yes, and we stumbled right into the air base. They were building an air base. And we had charts and entered the land, and there were pools where we could have anchored, but I ran into Slocum's problem. I don't know if you remember, he talked about kelp and how it would foul your anchor. Well, we tried two or three anchors and couldn't get an anchor down. And darkness was coming, and I said, fellows, we're going to swallow our pride and go back to that merchant ship that we saw tied up right to the shore. They had ramps from the ship right down to the land. So we went back and asked. They seemed very anxious to talk to us. And God bless the Brits. They had us under house arrest, but never told us they had us under house arrest.
So they arrested you, but they were so polite about it that you never realized you're under arrest.
That's right. Served us sandwiches and then gave us buns for breakfast. What we wanted from them was the use of one of their mooring buoys, one of those big things, 6 or 8 feet high, you know, to anchor on during the night. And by the way, we had an escort when we went out. We had to go outside to get to Stanley the next day. We were escorted out by three denizens of the Southern Hemisphere, three dolphins. And I don't know if you're aware that far south, they are black and white like killer whales.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, they look like they're in full tuxedos, you know, and Papa, Mama, and the baby. They escort us very close to the boat while we went through the cut. And the minute we got out in the open ocean, they left us. They were our escort into the ocean. It was kind of fun.
That's cool.
Then it was just from there, it was coastal piloting into Stanley. Interesting place, Stanley. A lot of military, a lot of Navy, and the British Navy just opened its arms to us. We got incredibly good treatment there. Okay, now the final, I'll go on to finish the landfall. The final landfall was a bit of a problem because we got caught in the Gulf Stream with a southwesterly wind blowing. Well, the current moves from toward the northeast. The wind was blowing toward the northeast, and we could not get enough angle to get out of the Gulf Stream without being carried toward Europe. I think one day we were carried 36 miles toward Europe while we were trying to fight our way out of the Gulf Stream. And it was a pretty gloomy time. It just very demoralizing. Well, finally, we got out of the Gulf Stream, got into pea soup fog, navigating the shipping lanes that come out of New York City. Almost got creamed by a German container ship. I was sure we were going to be hit. In fact, I told the guys we're being rammed. I get very quiet when I'm in real trouble. My family learned that in trailer trips to Alaska and around, that when we're in serious trouble, I got very quiet. If I was jumping up and down screaming, everything was fine. So the guys came out of the cabin, and the ship passed our stern, probably not more than 20 yards from us. No foghorn or anything. Radar swinging, antenna swinging, but no sound. Well, we dodged a bullet there. The sky cleared a little, but the cold front came in and covered the sky. We got a little wind, tried to aim toward Cape May, knew that we were 30 degrees off at least, but gradually the wind picked up, the sky cleared, and on the last morning I blew the Kluggraman out of the Yankee. I didn't want to change the sail. I wanted to keep it moving as fast as possible. And as we neared Cape May, a helicopter flew overhead with the Cape May Coast Guard painted on its sides. That was great. And then I saw the old 5-fathom buoy that replaced the 5-fathom lightship. Well, that was a place where I had trolled for fish years earlier, knew it well, and even in the daytime knew how to get from there to Cape May, even though Cape May is not visible from 5-fathom lightship position. But it's almost instinctive to turn in the right direction. And so they were the landfalls. And almost all of them are made within 15 miles of correct latitude.
That's just amazing. What would you tell somebody who wanted to learn to sail without navigational instruments?
Get sensitive to all the clues. Do you remember, I'm sure you don't remember, but they used to say about Chicago when it was a big packing plant city for meats, they said, we use every part of the pig but the squeal. Well, we actually used the squeal. We called it the squeak of the hatch.
Right.
But we used, we even used the bioluminescence on the waves that were breaking at night as a clue to direction. We used that as an angle. We used watercolor, bird life, just about everything that could be imagined. But I would recommend that they get sensitive and that they learn enough about, if they're going to do long distance, get acquainted with the ocean currents of the world and the watercolors and temperatures in those currents. That would be good to know. By the way, in 1980, we made a landfall in Africa, and you may be interested in this. We aimed for Dakar. Well, I happen to know from both theory and in person that Dakar is on a climate divide. South of Dakar, there's a kind of a scrub forest, but north of Dakar is the sand of the Sahara Desert. It comes right out to the ocean. So when we sailed to Dakar on the second no instruments trip, I aimed north of Dakar because I knew that if I saw the sand of the Sahara, it was a right-hand turn, and also the currents and run from north to south there, so I wouldn't have to buck a current. And in general, the atmosphere flows from north to south. So if I had landed aimed to the right, in other words, south of Dakar, I would have had to buck a fairly strong current with a fairly weak wind, and additionally would have risked the mud flats of the Gambia River. So I think it would be advisable for somebody to know the geography of the areas where they would make landfalls. It would be helpful. And to pay attention.
And to pay attention to everything.
I think I said that before, but I think it merits repeating.
Sure. Okay. What do you always want people to know about your trip that perhaps we haven't talked about? Is there anything?
What I'm hoping is that researchers will not say automatically that no serious sailing was done before the compass was invented or used. That's really what I set out to show, that long-distance sailing is possible. With some degree of accuracy. I won't say it's really accurate, but with some degree of accuracy, without the usual nautical toys. And I think if I did anything, it might have given researchers the heart to believe some of the evidence that they already have, like the pottery on the coast of Peru, for example, Chinese pottery on the coast of Peru. The standard explanation is that boats were randomly blown off voyage and landed there. Well, it could have been purposeful navigation. We're not sure. But I think researchers need to look at the evidence with a little more believing eye, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Sure.
So how long do you think man has been crossing oceans?
I don't really know. I don't think there was a lot of it, but I think there was some of it. I have read recently a book called 1421. I can't remember the author's name right now, but apparently the Chinese developed quite a fleet and sailed in the early part of the 1400s, whereas Columbus sailed in the latter part. And apparently, according to this author, they got to Africa and even into the Atlantic. But that's one book, one author's statement. He does not give footnotes, so it's a little hard to check his sources. But I think there was a lot more going on than we are willing to recognize. Now, one of the things that gave me part to sail without instruments was the fact that Lisa Lucky, the Viking, was able to leave a colony on northern Newfoundland and not have the people jumping up and down screaming, "Don't leave us here, don't leave us here." Apparently they accepted that with a firm belief that the Vikings were going to come back and service the colony. If they had not had that firm belief, I don't think they would have stayed there. So the fact that they did gave me reason to believe that the Vikings traveled with some degree of repetitive accuracy. And that gave me the heart to try and to do it.
What sailing have you done since your big trip?
I have a little compact made in Clearwater, Florida, 16 feet 11 inches, that I sail in Bogue Sound. I understand that the Baptist minister here in North Carolina sailed one out to Bermuda, but at 92, I have no inclination to try to repeat his voyage.
Well, you'd have to go blindfolded or something, with plugs in your ears.
Hey, I've taken it on some overnight trips, and I got into some pretty scary situations with that little 17-footer.
Sure.
That's a very nice little boat, though.
But I was out last week in it, and it's a delightful little boat, and it is called Globestar 2.
Oh, okay.
Roman numeral 2. I wanted it to be T-O-O. But I have a reputation for not getting my way in having boat names painted the way I want them painted. I wanted my boat for the trip to Africa and back was called Navstar, Navigation by the Stars. I didn't want to repeat that, so I chose Globestar, Around the Globe by Stars, but I was going to have it, because Navstar was all one word, I was going to have Globestar painted on, all one word, and certified to the Coast Guard in Philadelphia that was being done in Goderich, Ontario. But when the boat arrived in Greenwich, New Jersey, it was two words, Globestar. So when I called the Coast Guard in Philadelphia, they said, "We've already sent that to Washington. That'll cost you $100 to change it." Oh, well, I said, "I'll have it repainted when I get to Cape Town." They said, "You sail and we'll relieve you of your document."
Wow.
So the boat came to be called Globestar. And in South Africa, the Globestar, not Globestar, they put the accent on the second word. But that was Globestar. Now, when it came time for the people in Clearwater, Florida, to paint the name on Globestar 2, I sent them instructions to paint it T-O-O. This is Globestar 2, like a little bit of a joke, you know? No, it came with a Roman numeral 2 on it. I struck out twice on boat names.
They didn't make it one word, did they?
No, they did not. No. They didn't restore that error, thank God.
That's pretty funny.
Are there any questions you wish we'd asked?
Let's see. You didn't ask about fire at sea.
No, I didn't. You had a fire at sea?
It was the first time I had an oven, and it was a gimbaled stove, neatly done by some machine shops in South Jersey. But anyway, we were out putting solar panels on the deck. I had the frame already made, but didn't get time to get them attached till we sailed. So we're out in the middle of the Gulf Stream, sunning ourselves, putting on the solar panels. I had a loaf of bread in the oven, and flames started shooting out the hatch.
Oh, my!
I had taken advice and put the 3-pound extinguisher near the hatch, and it took the whole extinguisher to get the fire out. What had happened, it was pressure kerosene, and I'm a fan of pressure kerosene because it is relatively hard to ignite. But anyway, the control for the oven burner rubbed against the bottom of the oven door a little when you open the oven, and it did it just enough to open that valve. Well, that put a lot of kerosene under the stove, and into a block that was meant for insulation. It was like a bit of asbestos, and it absorbed it. And so when it got hot with the flames, started on fire, it kept burning, melting the kerosene out of the block. Very hard to get it extinguished. Well, I didn't realize at that point what had happened, and started the fire up the next day and got the same thing all over again.
Oh, no.
With a little less extinguisher required, because I caught it sooner. Well, then I just took the block out and threw it away. The insulation, you don't need much insulation on the bottom of an oven. You need it on the top, not the bottom. I guess one thing I would like to say is the tremendous cooperation that I got in getting the boat ready to go. I couldn't get insurance on the boat, because as soon as the insurers, the potential insurers, found out what I was going to do, they said, no, we will not issue you a policy.
Ah.
I tried Lloyd's of London. I tried casualty companies around the world. Nobody would touch it. But two insurance companies offered me a $100,000 policy on my life, which I thought was ridiculous. So I took up one of them, the South Dakota outfit, but I had sold life insurance during the 1930s, and life insurance exams then were a joke. Well, this turned out not to be a joke. They put me on a treadmill, and they did this, and they did that, and finally the doctor said, do you know you have a hernia? No, I don't have a hernia. Yeah, feel it here. Yeah, I did have a hernia. So that news came 2 months before I was to sail. The boat was built in Canada. The mast was built in Connecticut. The galley stow was built in California. All this had to be assembled and checked out before I could sail. And winter was coming. So I had the hernia repair, and then was told that I couldn't lift anything for 6 weeks or 8 weeks. And here I had a boat to get ready. Well, I had one buddy who was a sailor, and he enlisted his buddies, and they enlisted their buddies, and very quietly, the job got done. I would get one call at night, what's left to be done? And I would say, well, this has to be done, or that has to be done. And it all got done. The boat was rigged. The galley stow was installed with gimbals. A machine shop in Millville, New Jersey, provided the draftsman to draft the opening for the stove. They figured out how to put the kerosene tank in the under the cockpit seats. All the while, flexible line allows the stove to be gimbaled. Unbelievable. They swept 6 inches of snow off the deck one Sunday morning, put a ladder up the mast to install a radar reflector. My wife, was the old-fashioned type of person. She said, how are you going to repay all these people? I said, the only way I can repay them is to do the job that they're helping me to get ready to do. It's the only way. And so that kind of gave me a double incentive to pay attention and get the job done. But it was a remarkable effort, almost a kind of a total South Jersey or Southern New Jersey effort. And it gave me a good feeling out at sea.
Oh, that's very neat. That's really cool. You wrote a book about this, but has it ever been published?
No. The publishers, well, I think there was a spate of sailing books that some of the publishers got burned, maybe a little.
Mm-hmm.
They claim that there's not enough drama. Nobody drowned. I didn't lose anybody overboard. We didn't wreck the ship or go on the rocks or get dismasted.
So they weren't exactly sailors there at the publishing house.
It's all done. It's set up. I had it edited by my colleagues at Glassboro State, now Rowan University, and even set up on a Mac program. But a friend of my daughter's at Duke University Hospital switched it over to PDF, which I guess you got the...
Yeah, you sent it to me.
He put it in that form, changed it over from Mac to PC. But I have a friend who's working on it now, but he's got some kind of an in with Norton. He's published books with Norton. But people think I should be really disappointed. Well, I guess I'd have to admit to being a little disappointed. But the reason I sailed was I was curious to know whether it could be done. The idea hit me, as I said, in the middle of the night in the middle of the Atlantic. And I got to thinking about it, and one thought led to another, and it just got out of hand.
We have a question we ask everybody. So we got to ask you, what is the strangest thing you've ever found or seen on a boat?
Well, the strangest thing was a light on the Gullis Bank, and I had... one crew on deck at the time. It was a bit hazy, not real thick fog, but a thin fog. And this was at night. The light appeared to be about the size of a grapefruit, held 10 feet away from the boat, or 15, but we know it was farther than that. But it seemed to be on one side, and yet when we took the tacks, it would still be in the same place, even though we changed course or changed direction. And we could not explain it. Now, I've seen a lot of things and worked through explanations, and I stayed with them until I found an explanation. But I saw Jeff Hertelin at my wife's memorial service 3 years ago, and asked him if he ever came up with an explanation. No, he said he absolutely did not. Now, I was passed in 1978 on the first no instruments trip from Ireland to New Jersey. I was passed by a naval fleet, and I identified the ship way off to one side that passed us. All 11 ships passed us on our starboard side, but one ship passed us on our port side. I assumed that was the Russian reconnaissance vessel, and it had a different light. Figured that out, but I have never figured out what this light did and how it managed to be on the same side of us, even though we changed tacks rather rapidly. How it could be there, and yet it was not ephemeral. It was not a will-o'-the-wisp kind of thing. It was clear-cut. Pale yellow light.
Okay.
And it couldn't have been a planet. It couldn't have been the moon. It couldn't have been anything that I can think of. And that was the absolute strangest thing. Now, I kidded people about seeing UFOs, you know. And we put on survival suits when we went around Cape Horn, just in case we got tossed overboard, and said that, and I joke about saying that they were suits for space travel that we put on. No, they weren't. But and I joke about saying that that's where we would have expected UFOs, at the tip of South America. But what we saw was, I'm tempted to think UFO at the tip of Africa, but I'm not going to say it, and I don't know.
Well, okay. If one of our listeners writes in with an idea, I'll send it to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this has been wonderful.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, I talk too much, but I guess that's what you people...
we like.
Well, thank you very, very much, Mr. Kramer.
Thanks. All right. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Let me thank Marvin again for taking the time to talk to us.
He was so fascinating.
What
we really enjoyed it.
What an amazing adventure. What a talented man. I think that's the thing that impressed me the most about him, is how much thought he had given to every specific little detail of his voyage.
And if his book ever gets published, we will let everybody know.
Time is getting short for the Water Tribe for next year for the Everglades Challenge.
Yep, money's due in January.
If you're going to do it, start getting ready.
Absolutely.
My boat is coming along very well. It went 3D last weekend. Before, it was just this pile of plywood. And honestly, it was hard for me to get excited about a pile of plywood. But now, it's three-dimensional. It would sink, but it's three-dimensional. Now, the goal is, though, by Saturday, it won't sink anymore. All the hull will be together, and we'll have it fiberglass. So I'm pretty stoked. Get out there and get ready and join me next year in the Everglades Challenge. So who did we hear from this week, Christy?
Well, this week we heard from Brian and Bonnie, and they said, we've been missing podcasts, and we really hope that everything is okay with you two and your family, and that nothing bad has happened. Hope to hear from y'all soon. Take care and God bless. P.S. We took Sienna, our 55-pound black lab, with us on the boat when we went to the Straits of Mackinac during Labor Day. And she had a pretty good time, too, although we still got to work on her going to the bathroom on the boat in the middle of the night without my hubby taking her to shore in the inflatable kayak to go. If you or anyone has ideas, we'd love to hear them.
Yeah. Now, I sent him a message about the whole get a piece of artificial grass placemat thing and teach the dog to go on that and then drag it behind the boat to clean it off.
Yep. Because that's what Luke and Dee Dee do, right? Or they did that, something similar.
But if you have ideas for them, let us know. We'll pass them on. We'll read them on the air.
Absolutely.
We've been very busy, and I know we haven't been keeping up the volume of shows, but we're going to try real hard to keep the quality of the show up, and we're kind of excited. We've got in upcoming shows, we've got a guy who kayaked through the Bahamas and through the Caribbean.
Bill Bolger.
Yep, and my friend Gary It went up and got an interview with Phil Bolger, which we're very excited about.
Yep.
We got good things coming.
Yep. Next, we hear from Larry, and he says, wow, guys, you really hit your stride with this interview. Thanks for a fun show, Larry.
Thanks, Larry. Yep. Glad you enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
We would like to thank Gene and Connie for their generous donation. We really appreciate it. Thank you. If you'd like to help support the show, there's two ways to do it. There's a PayPal link on furledsales.com over on the right-hand side. We can donate some money. And if you don't want to donate any money, but you'd like to maybe buy us a book, then there's a link to our Amazon wish list full of some sailing books we'd like to read.
Well, thanks for joining us this week. Again, our show notes are located at www.furledsails.com. Email us at podcast@furledsails.com. See you on the water.
See you on the water.